Welcome to Modcast, a Civilization podcast focused on game modding.
Gilded Duke.
Hamble. With guest co-hosts...
Dalfishard.
Kale.
Plitbonk.
Welcome to number 49. This is Mark Hamble Ford, and our guests this week will be...
This is where we speak. This is Derek Kale Paxton. Thank you for having me.
This is Plitmaw. Thank you for having me.
And this is Alphashar. Thank you for having me.
I was a modder years ago. Started when Civilization IV came out in 2005. I started modding for it, created a fantasy mod called Fall from Heaven, and had just a lot of fun with that. I wasn't working in games at all, but they'd always been my passion, especially the Civilization series, and really loved the opportunity to get in and make something that was my own. After Fall from Heaven, after I got that all wrapped up, I had an opportunity to come work for Stardock and start making strategy games for them. So since that time, I've come to Stardock. I made a game called Fallen Enchantress and its expansion, Legendary Heroes, as well as working on some other of Stardock's games. So it was an opportunity for me to go from being working a grown-up job, I like to say, and to get out of that and come, make a career out of making games. So it really was a big turning point for me and a great opportunity. I'm so glad I started modding because I had that chance to do it, and now I get to do it on a daily basis.
So you live in the dream.
Yes.
Congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah.
I guess I can go next. I'm Alphashard, and I usually guest host on the Polycast show, but my modding experience is pretty light. I've only done like the Civ 4 INI file, a little bit of modding in the Civ 2, play with the INI file on that one. And then I also did, I forget exactly how I did, but I remember the graphic file with all the units for Civ 2. I remember seeing the little, he looked like a samurai, so I wanted to use him, so I put him in the game and I made him overpowered because I don't know, I was just playing around with him. I do like the Steam Workshop, and I've been playing with some of the mods on there, trying them, and so I'm new to this modcast, yes.
I have a love-hate relationship with Steam, but we'll go on with the profiles.
My name is Putmok, and last time I was on, I talked about how I was working on Civ 4 Diplomacy. That's the latest mod I worked on. That, I've really slowed down working on, because I'm shifting my focus to another project, but right now I'm trying to like keep that on the wraps. I'm not really going to ready to reveal it yet, so I'm spending a lot of time on that, but that's going to be like a massive total conversion where I change every system top to bottom, change every sieve and stuff. That I plan on like releasing in the next year or so I'm pretty excited on that. I really envy Kale on the got job in game industry for doing mods, and I really look up to that because I want to get into that career path as well, so that's what I'm working on right now.
Over this past week, I've been looking at mods that are out there in the community, and I noticed some of them are up in Steam and some of them aren't. Why isn't everybody using the workshop, or what's the reason that if you are making a new mod, you might want to choose one or the other?
Well, I host on both Civ Fanatics and Steam Workshop. I know Steam Workshop has a lot of issues for some reason. I have a lot of people telling me that they can't download it. Like, they click subscribe and then nothing happens, and that confuses me. So I use, the direct download, so if someone has a problem with the Steam Workshop, they can easily download it and put it in. But for some reason, there are some issues with how Steam handles downloading the files in game. So I'm not sure what's going on with that. But that's probably a reason why people aren't using it, because it's sometimes unreliable.
Okay. Makes sense.
What have we learned? This is going to be, I think, a reoccurring segment as long as B&W is still new, because not just modding, but gameplay, I think we learn a lot from the one-month-to-one-month modcasts. So I'll go ahead and start, I guess, get us going. I've learned that one-city challenges are much more challenging now between the requirements for three factories and a number of other issues. That used to be my main style of gameplay. I'm having to really adjust my gameplay now to try and figure out how to accommodate for that.
I have kind of an unusual relationship with Brave New World because I was involved in the beta for Civ 5 before release, so I played it for about a year and a half before it came out. And then at the point where it came out, I had played it so much that I never really played it after release, and I didn't play Gods and Kings. But then when Brave New World came out, that was my opportunity to say, okay, well, I'm ready to get back and play some Civ 5 and really see what's changed since the beta, And betas aren't always the best judge of a game, of course. So I've been playing Brave New World, having a blast with it, but it's a little hard for me to distinguish what's different from before and after because I didn't play much before. So my lessons that I'm learning are just a very full, very complete game I'm having fun with. And the Barbarian, they really suck, and that's why it's fun to play the Mongols.
I have to agree. I can speak more of the difference before and after because I think for the first time in the whole entire Civilization series, the late game feels more entertaining with the archaeologists and the tourism for culture, the new culture victory. And it really changed things up and made it less busy work, you know, hitting end turn constantly and more interactive and more demanding of your attention to get those things that you want.
Isn't it amazing just to see a Civ game that has that strong late game? I've loved Civ. It's my favorite series of all time. But I never remember thinking, oh boy, I can't wait to get to the late game because then it's, you know, there's lots of great things to do. And this is the first time that I felt like that, which is incredible.
Yeah, I agree, because in the past, I would usually, the only thing to do in the late game to be entertaining was to conquer anything that I hadn't conquered yet, you know, with tanks and bombers, and even that people didn't really like doing. So the archaeology is a really cool addition.
Or just try to get your turn victory number of turns down, you know, which was kind of a way to challenge yourself. But I really enjoy the end game. I found that when, in the previous, in Gods and Kings, and even before that, there was always a stalling point. You know you've won, but you still got a while to go in the game, and you're on autopilot for the end of the game, unless something spectacularly unexpected happens. And with BNW, that's kind of all changed. The end game is a lot more flexible now. There's a lot of ways in which, you know, you may have to alter your strategy. There's a lot of more depth to it, I think, than there was before.
I found the culture victory to be a lot easier. I remember there are just too many turns between the World Congress before you can get to the world leader, and I got the tourism done much quicker than Space Race or World Congress. I haven't even done a World Congress victory yet. And I was playing as Brazil, so that might have
there. Yeah, I was going to say, it really depends on who you get as rivals. If you get a good, strong tourism rival, then it can really be a difficult victory. But if you don't have one, then yeah, it's pretty quick.
Well, with that, don't you think there may be some balance issues, though? Because what I've noticed when I've played is that the World Congress seems to be the most dominant way, the easiest way to win the game.
I do not like that at all. Completely hate it.
Makes the late game kind of suffer, but I think it needs to be tweaked.
That's the only thing I have about Brave New World that I don't like. Everything else is good, though.
Well, I'm not sure what they're going to be addressing as far as balance issues with the fall patch. I know Thal's working on balance issues for his mod. Hopefully that will address some of them.
Like, you're finding it's just too easy to conquer the game with it, or?
No, my problem with it, I think, is its overall design. I do not like the fact that the host can just get the World Congress. You have maybe like 4 city-state allies, and then you're just going to be host the entire game if you just, it just expands. And then I don't like the fact that it really isn't diplomatic at all. If one guy has 23 votes and everyone else has 2 votes, nothing is going to pass. It's just going to be whatever the big guy wants, and I don't think that's diplomatic at all.
Well, you can buy his votes. As part of diplomacy, you can actually go in and buy votes from any of the other players for any resolution that you have up.
I know, but those can get very expensive very fast.
Yeah, they can, yeah.
You're not going to be able to buy them to be a host of the World Congress. I also didn't like the fact that the AI only thinks about itself. It's not, like, diplomatic at all. Like, what's the point, honestly, of having a special session of Congress?
I always felt that it was kind of ridiculous sometimes where I can't even get them to open borders, and I've done nothing with them before, and they have such negative slant to me for some reason that I can't even do a simple thing like, I say, open borders. They're like, no, that's too much. And I feel like it does need to be retweaked.
The price goes up a lot depending on their opinion of you, which you can't tell.
In my current Civ game, I was friends with Korea for like a long time as I was taking out other Civs. They didn't seem to care that I was warmongering. And I had a continent with me, Korea, and like 3 or 4 other Civs. And then when I was taking out the last remaining Civ besides Korea, they denounced me. And I think it was that denouncement that made Korea suddenly stop being friends with me, because I had been giving them stuff for the whole game up to that point. And then they stopped liking me. So it would seem like Korea was good friends with that Civ that I took out, which was the Celts. So it would be nice to see that relationship that the Civs have with each other that I know was in Civ 4. You could tell when they liked each other, so you know who was friends and who didn't like who. And I guess, yeah, you had the declarations of friendship, but they never made that. So I didn't know if they were friends or not or liked each other. And it wasn't until that last Civ that Korea started to not like me. So
Didn't Civ 4 have like a heat mapping kind of a thing where like when you went in to talk to someone in diplomacy, there was a color that told you whether they were mad at you or whether they liked you or not?
Oh, you could tell when they're mad at you, yeah. Like you can go in there and they, you know, say, oh, you know, scumbag, blah, 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 you know, yeah, they'll tell you. But in Civ 4, I remember there was a little chart and it would show all the Civs and then all the different relations when they contacted each other and how they viewed each other. It would show like annoyed between two other Civs and, you know, the Civ was guarded with this one or their ally of that one. So it was a very nice detailed look, you know, so you knew who liked each other.
All the pictures in the circle, right, with the lines going into each other, and you can see that red line, they're at war, and they're not.
Yes. Actually, I don't know if it's been updated for B&W, but InfoAddict does that.
Okay.
If you want to see what their relationship with is, I already added that in. I'm not with InfoAddict or anything like that, but that is, you can ask them.
Mm-hmm.
Is that what you're looking for?
In the picture of China, you're actually asking Lady China what she thinks about the Denmark guy, right, Bluetooth?
Yeah.
Yeah,
she's telling you what she's got with them. That's cool. That's cool. The one in Civ 4 was nice just because you could, at a glance, see everybody's relations to everybody, which is kind of nice. You kind of pick around. All right, let's see. Everybody hates this guy. That's kind of cool. I should go to war with him.
That's InfoAddict for you. I liked it, but I haven't added it in because it already exists. I'm not going to, duplicate something. You know what I mean? If someone else already made it, I'm saving myself the time to making that.
Right.
All right, well, I think that leads us well into Kale's modding guide, our first spotlight. Did you have experience before creating this guide and doing professional documentation?
Oh, yeah. I worked for a software company called Novell, working with a lot of insurance companies and banks and things like that and helping them out with their projects and putting together information for them, which is similar to this. Hey, listen, you're going to upgrade to the latest version of our product. You're going to roll this out across 1,000 servers. Here's the steps you need to go through to do it. So, yeah, that's what I did for a living.
So that explains why it's so well put together. What inspired you to create the guide in the first place? A lot of work.
Yeah, it was. Firaxis had been kind enough to allow me into the beta process for the game, and I really appreciated that they did that. And in particular, there's a guy over there, his name's Sean Seckman. He was the guy who does a lot of the modding stuff and fought for modding integration through the process of Civ 5. And as I was tinkering with it, playing with it, I'd ask Sean questions and he would answer my questions, which is fantastic, but unfair for me that I got, the access directly to the Firaxis guys and I got to ask them all this stuff. And I didn't think it was very fair for me to just keep that information myself. If Sean's spending 15 minutes explaining something to me, then I wanted to make sure that was a very valuable time. So I wanted to make sure that information got out, not just to me, but got out to everybody. So that's really why I wanted to get that guide together so that everybody could take advantage of the very cool and amazing opportunity that I had.
A lot of people have written guides and or different tutorials and whatnot, but yours still stands kind of alone at the top of the heap. So what makes a good guide? What recommendations would you have to folks putting together documentation today to make it as useful or as good as what you've done?
The important part is assume that your reader doesn't know anything that you know. I've tried to grab some guides for a couple different things over the past week, just other stuff that I'm working on, and I'm always amazed at how much, they're telling me something, and I feel like I'm a fairly competent guy, but I don't know, because they're referring to something that they haven't mentioned before. So I'm like, well, I hear what you're telling me, and I understand, but I don't know what that thing you just mentioned actually is. So if you're writing a guide, assume that they don't know anything. Walk them through piece by piece, every step. Pictures are fantastic, even if they're just screenshots. They don't need to be fancy Photoshop things, but take screenshots and put a red box around the thing that you're talking about so that anybody in the world can sit down and kind of walk through those things. It not only will make your guide appeal to more people, but it'll just make it so much easier for them. That way they're not a little frustrated with that. Well, when he's talking about this, what's he looking for? And they're looking in the wrong place. So they're spending that extra 10 or 15 minutes. You really want them to be able to step through A, B, C, go through, have done something at the end of the day. Which is why the guide kind of walks through the creation of a civilization, walks through the creation of a unit, and actually takes them through common things so you can feel like after they've gone through it, hey, look, they have something new that they've made. We want them thinking about, oh, that's cool, and I know how I would use that in a new way. That's where their mind should be, not in, what is he talking about here? I don't get this, or what's this thing that he's referring to? So try to get rid of as many of those thoughts so they can concentrate on being creative.
And then, of course, the dreaded final question that you've probably been asked many times, when are you going to update your guide?
For a little bit of backstory, one of the deals with me writing this guide, is it did take a lot of time, is that I was going to put it out 2 weeks before Civ 5 released. And I thought that would be very cool for the modders so they could start reading and thinking about what they were going to do when the actual game came out. So I wrote it and had it all ready to go 2 weeks before release, sent it to Firaxis, and the guys at Firaxis are amazing. They're just the best guys in the world. Sent it to them, they're like, oh, this is all cool, and they sent it to 2K, and 2K said, no, you can't put this modder's guide out because it shows you how to make a sieve, the Celts, in fact, and they were planning on doing that as DLC. So they said, well, we don't want you to put a modder's guide out there and show people how to do this because, you know, we're going to put out DLC for it later on. So they said, no modder's guide. So since I was under NDA at the time, I couldn't put it out early. But once the game is out, all that information that's in there is all public aware. So the second the game came out, boom, I put the modder's guide out, and I wasn't going to not release it. Haven't gone back to it since. Of course, right after Civilization V came out, I got the call from Stardock, hey, you want to come make games? And so I've switched away. I haven't made any mods for Civilization V that weren't in that first month. So I made like three of them that came out first month, just little things just to kind of show what could be done. And I don't really have any plans, and I would be the worst person in the world to go and update it now because I'm just not aware of what's going on with the mod capability of Civ V anymore.
Pretty sure there are tons of people out there who would love to be able to make edits to the document to update it a little bit. I'm pretty sure there'd be many people willing to do that if it's possible to put like a link to allow people to edit it.
I think that's a great question. I'll do that after this podcast to put the doc version out there. So if people want to own it moving forward and keep it up to date and update it with all the changes, yeah, that's a great idea.
It may be a little tricky to find someone. We may have to have a couple people edit it, actually.
Like a team of people.
Yeah.
That's kind of the beauty of the modding system, right? Of this, having this community, and says you do get people that are, they're not working on it 40 hours a week, but if they have an evening on a Tuesday and they really dig into some component of moddability and civilization, like, and they find out cool stuff, then it'd be really neat if they could go to the modder's guide or maybe submit to somebody that owns a modder's guide and say, hey, here's a section that I think should be added. It's how you do this one particular thing. And somebody looks over it and says, yeah, this looks cool, and gets it in there. And you do get to benefit from all of that. There would have never have been a fall from heaven if it wasn't for the community at Civ Fanatics that was teaching me and figuring out things on their own so that I didn't have to figure them out and coming up with all those great ideas. It's why I always shared everything in Fall from Heaven. All the source code was always available. All of the everything was out there so that if anybody could use any part of it, they were welcome to it, because so many other people were doing that with their mods and allowing me to kind of take advantage of what they'd already learned.
I'm sure every path is different, but to have gone from a modder to a game developer, do you want to talk a little bit about the steps you took and how you got there? Because I'm sure a lot of people that are modders are interested in that kind of thing. Not that it's likely to happen to just everyone, but still.
I interview lots of people and hire people into Stardock too. So one thing I always like to see from anyone is, yes, I understand you may have a degree in this. I understand that you may be very passionate about games, and I understand you may play a lot of games, but what have you made? What have you created on your own? It doesn't matter who you are. If you want to be a game designer and you're not making games on your own, doesn't matter. Nobody's paying you to. Doesn't matter that, you know, you don't have a team to work with. If you're a programmer and you're not writing little games on your own, if you're an artist and you're not creating art in your own time, even if nobody's paying you to do it, then I question a little bit what your passion is. So to get into the game industry at all is going to be hard. I have a stack of resumes that's 3 inches thick, literally 3 inches thick of people that are, they're always applying and always wanting to get in. So to separate yourself from that group, you have to create something. You have to create something you're proud of. For me personally, it was an opportunity to work through lots of things that I thought I knew. And then once you start to do it, you realize, oh, okay, that doesn't make sense, or I understand that a lot better now. And to make me feel like I was ready to come into the game industry. And then since working here at Stardock, I've gotten to work with people like John Schaefer and Soren Johnson and Brad Wardell, and realize, oh, I really don't know that much. I'm always learning and always trying to talk to these guys and learn even more.
Well, Mulk, now that you have told us that you are really slowing down on the development for Civ 4 Diplomacy, let's talk about Civ 4 Diplomacy.
Okay. I think one of the things about what my original goals with the mod was really because I loved Beyond the Sword so much that I wanted to kind of get that in the game. And I think the best place to tackle that was the diplomacy because a lot of people had issues with it. But the thing of my goal is, and I think people kind of misunderstand where the mod is supposed to go. Like, I brought in the diplomatic features of the mod, like map trading and tech trading, because that was all the stuff that was in the game. But I think people expect me to like radically overhaul the AI, and I can do that, but that's a lot of work. After a while, I found out that I'm actually almost done with all the features that I wanted to add, because to think about it, I think the only things I have left to add is permanent alliances and maybe like a few other tweaks here and there.
So everything that's on your very likely list from your post on Steam is either done or is going to be done?
That stuff I posted before Brave New World came out and before I really got a passion to work on the new project. I still want to tackle some of the stuff on that. I think one of the things that I'll do at some point is the aircraft bombing the improvement tiles. Now, that has nothing to do with diplomacy, but I remember that as a feature from Civ 4. You can, like, pillage tiles and stuff. And now, for my new project, where I've been working on, like, combat and stuff, I know how targeting and all that stuff works. It will be possible for me to handle that. It's just that I have to buckle down and do it, and I have to take time away from other things. And, you know, with semester starting soon, it's going to really pile up. I've been working on asking the AI to move troops from your borders and stuff, because I think a lot of people had issues with that. So I'll put that in at some point, go through that list and really tackle them, because I want to get them done. They're on that list for a reason.
Trying to bring back some of the features that were in Civ 4 that you liked.
Yeah. I don't know if that's confusing to some people. I think I've got some people who thought it was for Civ 4, but it's supposed to replicate Civ 4 diplomacy in Civ 5.
One of the things you have listed as, and you've said you actually either completed or are going to complete for the BNW version, is the ability for permanent alliances. But you say that it's after the first ideology is unlocked. So are you going to require that they share ideologies in order to form a permanent alliance?
Probably. I would do that. Because if you think about what permanent alliances is I assume it's supposed to replicate maybe like the European Union or World War II, World War I alliances and stuff like that. I mean, why would an AI who's a different ideology than you ever want to become a permanent alliance with you? Like, you know what I mean? Because if you think about what permanent alliances are, they're just merging of teams. Now you become a one.
Yeah, like NATO or that kind of thing. Yeah, or like European Union, like you said.
Yeah. You can really form alliances with your freedom allies or your fellow order comrades or whatever.
Comrades. You communist.
Oh, that's what order is for.
I thought this was something that was already released, so I actually went and looked on Steam, and I saw something for about the diplomacy values of each of the little reactions, like it's, you know, plus one for having an embassy, and it actually shows the plus one. Are you going to have something like that where it shows the pluses and the minuses for the values?
Yeah, actually, I was thinking of that, because that's something definitely a big feature of Civ 4. But for me, I thought I actually really love the Civ 5 diplomacy system where it's kind of hidden. So I was probably going to add a game option that if it was added, if you clicked it, then I would show the values. And those values are pretty set in stone. It's very easy for me to pull them, to display them to the user. So yeah, that's a good idea.
I wanted to ask you about tourism and trade. Have you worked those into your formulas for your tech trading?
No, I haven't messed with the tech trading in a while, but right now, the way it works is the AI looks at the tech. They look at how many turns I have to research it. They look at what the tech gives. So yeah, I'm probably going to add something in there to increase the value if it like provides a trade route or something. But I have to be careful because every time I add something to that formula, then the price of the tech inflates. So I have to really get down and balance it. So I have to be careful on that. But yeah, I'll be changing that.
So in the conversion to Brave New World, you know, what kind of difficulties did you face?
I think the biggest thing with the conversion process was my old system's kind of inefficient. It was kind of stupid because when I'd add edits in, I would put them in like where it's like convenient for me, like where something was similar to that. I put my edits underneath that. But for the conversion process, I really buckled down and I really organized and sectioned my code off to make it easier to manipulate. So I took like all of my functions that may have been spread out across the code and be like a hassle to find. I threw them all in the bottom of the file and they're all like in their own spot. So it's really easy. And then I started marking all my changes so that it can identify what I've done and I can locate them faster. So the biggest problem was getting all the data that I had from the Gods and Kings version and organizing that to put into the Brave New World version, because if I miss something, for example, then things are going to work differently and I had to be careful that I didn't accidentally forget something. Also, I think the biggest challenge I have when working with the source code is saving and loading, because they're very, very specific. If you even mess up one line on the serialization process, it will crash every save and it will never be recoverable. So you have to be very, very delicate and make sure everything matches up, saving and loading, because otherwise it's gonna fail. I did notice that I had to change some things when I ported over. For example, I had a few warmonger tweaks in the Gods and Kings version, and I would make it a less penalty for declaring war and a greater penalty for capturing a capital, some of that. But in Brave New World, they completely changed the way the warmonger penalties got assessed. So they already took what I did with the declaration of war and they set to my value. They halved it and then they completely got rid of the warmonger penalty for conquering a person. They changed it to a per city capture warmonger penalty. So it works a little differently from the Gods and Kings version. And then I think I did a few tweaks here and there and I noticed some bugs that I plugged up. So my version, I think it's version 8 right now that's up, is more stable than it was.
You still take the biggest hit for actually wiping out a civilization or taking in their home city, right?
The way it works is it's based off a formula. I had looked into how it worked in. It's a set value, so like 10, and then the source code is 1,000, but that's for integer.
Right.
It's based off the map size, so it'll like multiply, and I don't remember everything offhand. It'll like multiply by the estimated number of cities that it thinks the map size should have. So if it's like standard, that's 52 or something. And then it divides by the number of cities that the loser had when you captured them.
It's not straightforward anyway.
No, it's not. It changes because the goal, I think, was if you capture a city on a civilization that has a lot of cities, it's not as bad as capturing a city of a civilization that has like 4 cities or something. So if you capture one with 20, you get like 5 times less hit than if you captured one with 4 cities. When you capture the final city, you wipe them out, they don't have any more cities. So that formula blows up and that's a huge warmonger hit, but it's not like implicit. It's not saying, oh, you killed the civilization. Now you get that penalty. It's based off the formula and that it's roughly the same thing that happens. In my opinion, though, you get a lot more warmonger points very quickly if you keep conquering. So I kind of like it.
I'll ask the dumb guy question because I haven't done any source code changes for Civ 5 because the source code wasn't out when I was way back when. But how does that work with other mods with source code changes? Is it able to merge those or what does it
do? No, it's completely isolated. I have a lot of requests, you know, for people who want to play my mod with the 34 Civs DLL and others, but it's not feasible. You have to actually physically merge them into one. So I have to take source code from mine and source code from his and merge them. And if there's going to be 7 DLLs that, you know, people want to play all different 7 combinations, it's just impossible for me to be able to do that. So if people want to play my mod, I post my source code up so they can look at it at any time and they can make changes and they can make their own DLL, throw it in, and it should be compatible. But it is not compatible in any way default. Like, the game has no idea what's going on. It loads one, and if the other one's there, it doesn't load it. And then everything that worked on that DLL doesn't work anymore.
Okay, did you do a lot of programming before you started working on Civ 4 Diplomacy?
Well, I'm still a college student, right? So I started my freshman year, I was in programming classes. So I did C++. I'd say I had off a year or a year and a half of formal experience before I looked at the source code. And before that, maybe here and there. But I really didn't start. I started programming for like a year, but it's not like advanced because I was still learning it. Now I think I'm in a pretty good spot with that. And it's easier for me to be able to make more complicated changes in the source code.
It's really a great way to learn. If you're wanting to take that step from the theory to the concrete, working on something like this really will get you there.
I have to say modding Civ 5 is the absolute best thing I've ever done, because I'm trying to get into the game design industry anyway, so this is working, because I get to see how professional developers, you know, make their code and how they structure it, and it gives me a lot of experience in learning about what I should do and what should I be looking for, ideas to solve challenges that I'm going to have in the future. So this is a great opportunity. Being able to see how professional artificial intelligence is designed, because I really have an interest with artificial intelligence, so I get to see how they made their AI at least attempt to replicate human behavior, though it doesn't do the greatest job. It's really hard for that to happen.
Yeah, and it's not just working code, it's Firaxis code. You know, these guys know what they're doing. It Tim Kipp and Brian Wade and those developers are the best at what they do. So when you're looking at their code and you're learning from them, they're the best guys to learn from.
The only thing I really do with the team is the language translations, because I don't speak, you know, Russian or Chinese, Spanish, so I have people to do that. They're really great. I'm really thankful that they're able to translate the mod for me, because it really expands my audience to people who won't be able to understand English. It's really nice. Firaxis, and I'm very thankful that they give me and all the other modders the opportunity to actually change their game, and we can create something really special. And I'm very thankful that they have the source code released so that we can really change how the game's structured. And I'm really excited for the creativity that we're going to see. I think maybe in the next year we're going to see some really, really nice mods come out.
Yeah, we're starting to get to the point now where modders are cracking some of the more difficult problems, like the animation and units and things like that, you know. And so we're going to see Civilization mods and just mods in general that are better looking, better integrated with the game as far as graphics go. And then I think because when the fall patch comes out, we're going to see some interesting things done with sound.
Oh, I can't wait.
which brings us to mailbag.
Yeah.
The first question someone sent us was whether or not it's possible to mod tiles and sounds. There was recently a discussion about the fall patch, and they do plan to add the ability to mod sounds.
Yeah, I've heard that. That would be great. Being able to have custom civilizations with custom music will be fantastic. I think we're going to see some really high-quality mods. Like, I think Irkilla, I don't know how to pronounce his name, is doing the high-quality civilization mod with Sumeria and Sparta, and they look fantastic, like, from top to bottom. And if they get custom music, it'll look like downloading a DLC. Like, you could pay for that.
I think the Warcraft mods are pretty good, too, in terms of graphics. So I'm curious to see what they'll do with more power or more abilities.
I have not seen the Warcraft mods, but they have a great lore to back it up, so I'm pretty sure they're doing a good job.
There's Elder Scroll mods, and I even found Australia and Canada Civilization on the Steam Workshop.
When they talk about sound files, have they said how extensive that's going to be? For example, if I wanted to add a new tech and wanted to have a voiceover for that, like they do with the other techs.
I don't know exactly how they're going to do it. From what I understand and how the sounds work, and I haven't actually done any modding with sounds, they have like the XML files for sounds specifically, and what we do, you can add a new entry with the new link to the sound file, and it'll play that. The only problem is that it doesn't update for us for some reason, so we have to replace existing sounds. So when they change that, we should be able to add new sound defines and get our new audio in mod really and throw them into the mod file. So I think it's possible now to get custom music, but it requires replacing existing music. If you look in the sounds folder in your expansion files, you'll see all the XMLs for all the 3D and 2D scripts that will play depending on the situation.
Well, now we just got to put out a call on the forums for someone who can do a good Leonard Nimoy impression.
And we can get Civ 4 tech quotes.
Yeah.
Civ 4 tech quotes plus Civ 4 diplomacy. So you just might as well just buy Civ, just play Civ 4 and Civ 5.
I don't know. I tried going back to Civ 4, you know, and the hex grid really is a huge upgrade. And you don't realize how much of an upgrade it is until you go back to Civ 4 and try and play again.
Yeah.
It makes the world look so much more, again, organic and just kind of real, since you don't see those squares. And they did such a great job. The art team on Civ 5 did such an amazing job of making it just a really beautiful world to kind of play in and fight in and get your spearmen killed in.
They did. I was annoyed, actually, initially when I first bought the game, because I had a hard time playing it on the computer I had at the time. And I was like, really, this is going to be too graphically intense for my computer. It's a turn-based game. But, you know, when I got a computer that could play it well and I really got to see the graphics and the animations and everything, it, you know, I stopped being quite so grumpy about it.
It's always a hard line for any developer to draw, where they want to provide the best game they can for their customers, but customers have old machines to new machines, so they want the guys with the new machines to be able to take advantage of that and have beautiful things, and the guys with the old machines to still be able to play. And you can say, well, we'll set up option sliders that turn things on and off, but that only gets you so much. There's infrastructure things in the game that have to be set up and configured, and big, large-scale architecture questions that have to be targeted to one end or the other.
My computer was, I mean, the only way I could actually even play on anything other than a small map was to play in essentially in a strategic mode.
Yeah, and the patches helped a lot with that too. So even on the same box, as patches came out, as it went up to Gods and Kings, performance improved, in my opinion.
Yeah. As far as tiles, I wasn't 100% clear on this question. You can do a lot of editing of what goes on a tile, you know, whether it's a forest, whether it's Fallout. And I think that you can change the type of a tile to certain things. Can't you change it from like a plain to a grassland or something, but you just can't change it to like a hill or something like that? It won't show up graphically until you reload, right?
Well, I ask this question a lot of times myself because, you know, I'm going to need to be terraforming, which is what that's referred to as changing, you know, terrain and features and stuff like that. Frustrating, because what if I change a tile to ice, for example, and it doesn't appear and then it's blocking somebody? It looks, it's jarring. It actually is pretty funny because me and my friend who's working with me, we made a joke, and it's like, we can do anything we want to do except terraforming, because that's the only thing that's right now. It's really a pain. And from what I hear, like, the function works correctly. It's just the graphics DLL doesn't reflect the changes at all. It's like it reflects changes to forests because you can chop them down. It reflects changes to jungles because you can chop them down. And I've experimented in game, and you can add forests and delete forests at any time, but it just doesn't reflect other changes for some reason.
Sometimes you can do something with features people originally tried to do with tiles. For example, I was having a conversation with someone who wanted to have a, like a scourge, you know, that would spread from tile to tile slowly and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
They were thinking that they needed to do tile changes, but it turns out you can implement that as a feature.
Yeah.
So sometimes some creative thinking can get you around it. But yeah, but the bottom line is a graphics engine, which we do not have access to. So,
nope.
We can't do much about that. It just doesn't reflect the changes until there's a reload.
Yeah, I'm hopeful that the fall patch will address that issue. So
I don't know. I don't think they mentioned anything about
Yeah,
it.
They haven't. I've asked around. They haven't mentioned that. So I hope maybe that gets pushed through sometime.
I didn't see any terrain edits, but I did see that some of the resources were modified. Someone had put in chocolate or something. It looked like it was chocolate.
Yeah, I think it's possible for us to reskin or add new models in for resources. Mm-hmm. I think that was cracked a few months ago, although I can't remember exactly when.
Yeah, I think that the thing that people are working very, very hard on right now is the leader heads. And once they can do something with that, then we can have something besides static leader head. And they'd have to be pretty talented. So breaking the barrier of how do we do it is one thing, but then actually creating a fully animated leader head, that's going to be interesting to see who has the ability to do that.
The potential is very high. The only problem is art assets in general are usually very expensive for a reason, because they're very difficult to create. So unless we have some really talented artists, maybe static leader heads will look better in the long run.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely a big difference between making a 2D picture, a beautiful 2D picture, and making somebody that moves and is animated, and that can be a tough job.
Well, and speaks in mouth moves in unison with what they're saying, too, which is, you know, that takes some coordination.
Absolutely.
So the other thing we have in Mailbag is a question about Java to Lua, basically, or more generically, object orientation to Lua. I think that there's more commonality than you might think, and the reason for that is that Lua is very, very flexible. There's obviously some things that are syntactically different, like the fact that it uses an end instead of braces to group things, but you can really make your Lua code look like Java code, you know, to some extent if you want. In terms of object orientation, Lua is capable of object orientation, but obviously in a very limited way compared to something like Java or C++. In fact, if you wanted to look at Follow and Cover, which is actually, it's up on Steam, it's been renamed to Escort at the moment, it does use some object orientation for determining. I think there's a follower object, there's a leader object, there's a number of different objects in there that act autonomously, and you know, someone could look at that as to get some ideas, and that is borrowed from some work that W. Howard did originally. So it is possible to do, and it is interesting, and it has some power to it. I would say it's probably somewhere between its capabilities at the moment, JavaScript, and maybe PHP. So it has some limited object orientation capabilities. I don't think it would be difficult for anyone to make a transition from an object-oriented language to Lua. They just have to keep in mind that because Lua is so flexible, if you go out and buy a Lua book, say how to program in Lua, the way that that person approaches Lua may be very foreign to you, and it may not make a lot of sense or may confuse you. So pick a book carefully if you're going to go that route, because you will find something that will match up well with your style, I think, if you look around a bit.
I do some Lua for mostly interface work, and I've noticed, it is very flexible on the syntax. It's not as restrictive, you know, as other languages. I've worked with Java, very object-oriented. It resembles C++. My advice, if you're doing object-oriented, I don't think necessarily, unless you're really something really elaborate, you have to actually create your own classes with Lua. But mostly everything you work on, like when you're doing interface or rules changes, you're working with pre-existing objects. Like the player is an object, the unit is an object, so if you're familiar with how to call member functions and stuff on those objects, then you should bind with LUA. And really, if you have any programming experience at all, this for Access LUA, it should be no problem. It should be an easy transition. If you really want to get down, though, the only problem with LUA, a lot of the functions are restricted than what we can do than if we go into C++, because for some reason, some functions that would be very useful are left out from the LUA to C++ connection. You have to actually go into the source code itself, and then you can use object-oriented to its fullest potential.
Yeah, I think one of the issues that we have right now that I've noticed when I went in to try and update my mods was that the old documentation is broken, the old wiki, and there is no new wiki. So I've kind of had to actually go to the C++ and Lua source code to try and figure out what the heck I needed to do, and that slowed me down quite a bit.
I really do the same thing, because I usually have the source code open a lot because I work with that and I prefer doing all of my work in the source code. But if I need to do something in Lua, then I can just easily open up where it goes and find the function that I'm looking for and see if it exists.
I went in and looked. I was surprised, actually, because they had done the way that they had structured things in the past in terms of the C++ and the Lua. I went in looking for classes specifically, you know, for the World Congress or for trade or for tourism, and there's nothing. They must be all integrated within other classes somewhere, and I have to go dig them up.
Voting classes, CPP, that's where the World Congress is stored. That has a lot of classes in it, but as far as I'm aware, they don't have a league class for LUA. What they may use is game, and the game object may have the list of all the active leagues, and league is like the first Congress, second Congress, third Congress. So that's a league. Like each one of those is a league. So the games may have it. So if you're looking for something like that, then you probably want, you're looking for a league. You're looking for the active league if you're trying to change something in the act.
But you're going to have to poke around for these things. They're not going to be as obvious as, you know, cbplayer.cvp or something like that.
Yeah, you spend a lot of time like looking at how they structure things so you can modify it yourself. I also, like, if I'm looking for something for LUA interface, I usually go into their files and look at how they structure something, because they may have something that's useful for me that I may not know how to do at the moment.
With art assets, what are your guys' general opinions on the availability of art for modders? The availability of custom graphics, like unit graphics, like yep. From what I noticed is that Civ 4 has a massive library of unit graphics to mess with and use, but Civ 5, I don't know, it seems like it's restricted to maybe a few talented people, but there hasn't been many other units created.
Back in the day, when I'll be the old guy on the podcast, I used to look at the Civ 3 units longingly and be like, look at all those units that are out there. For Civ 4, there's only this tiny handful. There's like 12. And if I go to Civ 3, there's hundreds. So you're in the same place. The units will come. I saw even somebody's taken the Fall from Heaven units, the Stone Skin Ogre and the Orcs from Fall from Heaven, and they've made Civ 5 versions of them, which looked amazing. So it will come. It just takes time. It took us a long time, too, to figure out how to do all the things, all the animations, to just kind of be able to make them. And once we figured out how to make them, just tons of people started putting them out.
Yeah, on Civ Fanatics, In the creation and customization area, there is actually a sub-forum for units. And like you said, it's not as extensive as Civ 4 was, but there's a fair amount of them in there, and you can use them. You can get ideas from it there also. And it's also a good place to find people that do unit graphics and maybe message them and say, hey, can I get some help on this or that, or would you be willing to help out with this?
One thing that always helped me with Fall from Heaven was people are modding for fun. They're doing it in their spare time. They may have a lot of ideas that they want to do, and then they don't get around to doing them because real life, it has an effect. You know, I'm working on this real passionately for 2 weeks, and then, you know, you go away for 2 months. So for me, it wasn't about finding one person and tasking them. It was about creating the list of these are all the assets I need. I need all these different units, and here's some guidelines on what they should look like, and then putting that out to the community and saying, hey, guys, here's all this stuff. If any of these inspire you, then jump in and help out with it. But making sure everybody can see the list of stuff that needs to be created, and then people will jump up and be like, hey, that sounds kind of cool. I could do that tonight. They could bite off that little piece and send it in to you. And that was a really good system, because if somebody was really passionate, they could jump in for 2 weeks and do a lot of stuff, and then they leave for 2 months, that's absolutely fine. There's no pressure. We appreciate any time they put in.
Yeah, if you can get some, especially if you can get some momentum going, it can be a little difficult sometimes just to do that. I mean, I have posted a few projects myself where I've tried to get community involvement, and it's not always easy. Once you get it going, once you have people interested and you have a momentum, then it can be a fantastic thing. Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659. That's 301-637-POLY. In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY. You can Skype us at The Polycast or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com. For more information on Modcast or sibling shows Polycast, Revcast, Turncast, or about Polycast in general, log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net. Well, it depends on what you consider a classic, too. I mean, Skyrim is a great game. There's a lot of great games out nowadays that probably will become classics. But I think of a classic as something like the original Civilization or Railroad Tycoon or
Pong.
Pong. No.
I had to say it.
Yeah. Wasteland. Remember Wasteland?
I think if you want to call something classic, it has to stand the hype. It has to, like, pass all the hype that's around it. We can't just come out and say BioShock Infinite is a classic. It just came out. Like, there's still people so hyped about it. Wait until, like, 10 years from now. Is it still a good game in comparison?
Yeah. Halo's a classic. I'll give it
Civilization 4 is about to hit that, I think. Maybe in, like, a year or two, right? It came out
2005.
Five. I thought it was four. Okay, yeah. So that is still close, you know, to becoming a classic. I think right now you could say it is. I'm actually going to say that because I think it is stood the hype. It's sequels out, and it's still such a high-praised game. It's still considered the best in the series, you know what I mean?
So we know Michael's working. His new mod's going to have terraforming in it. We figured that out.
It's going to have a lot more than that. Like, some of the ideas, I'm really sorry I can't say anything right now. I really want to, but I don't have anything to show.
But it's going to be awesome, though.
I can say this, it's going to be more like RPG type thing, so if you want to play Civ RPG, have fun.
What do you guys think about that, by the way? What's the thoughts?
Seen the trailer, but from what I hear, it's like an MMO, but it has nothing to do with like turn-based stuff, so I'm like, what?
Yeah, I said you can work not only military against each other, but you can be people that are helping build the buildings and research the techs, and I'm just imagining sitting at some wheel, you know, clicking research, so I don't know.
Is it going to be like World of Warcraft, except with history or something, like real life? I don't know what it's looking for.
I don't know, but my take on it was that they said that, you know, military isn't going to be the only focus, even though there will be some wars. They really wanted to play up to my empire against yours, not just from a military standpoint, but us trying to build wonders and build buildings. And
well, is it a strategy game, or is it like a third-person type thing?
It's an MMO, so I'm playing one person in my empire.
How are they going to get, like, an empire worth of people?
I don't know. The art looked really cool, though. It was pretty.
Yeah. I hope they know what they're doing.
Hope it's better than Civ
World.
Well,
this isn't the first go-around, which could be good or bad. There are no plans from Stardock to take their flagship strategy game into an MMO.
I think it's pretty safe to say that Stardock's not going to be starting an MMO anytime soon.
Okay.
Massively multiplayer, like four people can be in this game.
Yeah.
I'm just imagining a massively multiplayer Civilization game where it actually is turn-based. So there's 3,000 people in this game, and it's person 2,847's turn. He's taking his turn, and then we'll keep going around.
That ties us up for episode 49. We are signing off. This is Mark Campbell Ford.
This is Derek Kale Paxton. Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
This is Putmog. Thank you for having me.
And this is Alpha Shard. Thank you for letting me on the show. I had fun.
And thank you to all of our listeners. And we will see you on Modcast 50. Welcome to Modcast, a civilization. I screwed that up. Thank God for editing.
You know, Sid Meier's, you need to make him into a celebrity, make him into a star. And they did it, and it worked great.
Well, he was already the biggest name in game design, I think, at the time anyway, so.
He almost made me flunk out of college from playing Civilization instead of doing my homework, so.
Oh, shit. I'm in college now. You're afraid.
If we could have Kale and Astral and Alpha Shard and I'm going to re-say that because Dan's going to have to edit that. Alright, I think that ties us up for episode 49.
I have a question.
Unless somebody else has something they want to add at the end here?
Yeah, I have a general modding question. So I was looking through some of the mods this week.
I want to thank all our guests for being here. Pup Milk,
Alpha Shard. Can you hear me okay?
And Kale.
Hamble, can you hear Kale?
Hello, Hanel.
See everyone next. Well, not everyone. I will see some of you and hopefully all of our listeners.
And Bill?
On episode 50.
What the heck just happened?
I don't know.
Thank you all for showing up.
I don't think you can hear any of us.
Hey, Mark. Hello.
You can say goodbye.
Sure we can, but will you hear us?
What the heck?
If you're listening to this podcast right now, things have gone out of control.
Did I drop connection? What happened?
Hey, Dan, you left and everything went crazy.
I can't hear anybody else talking, so there must be some problem.
Say goodbye, everybody.
Nope, no more questions from you. I would like to talk now. No, Stardock boy, you're done.
Oh man, that's gonna be fun edit.
Are we ready for goodbyes this time for real?
Yeah, I think so for real.
Yeah. I mean.
All right.
Wait, I have a question.
Wait, somebody's still talking. This is Modcast 50. We're signing off with...
It's Modcast 49.
Sorry, Modcast 49? Wow, what a day.
I think we did a good episode. That was fun.
Informative.
I thought the guests were incredibly witty.
I listened to that one, and that one was good, too.
Record date, August 17th, 2013. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive.
Copyright Civilized Communication @civcom.net.